The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, the question of the day right now is deflation. We're hearing it a lot, and people are asking, what are the ramifications of deflation?
Well, Kevin, we started to become familiar with a different vernacular, a different vocabulary starting back in 2006, where we went from a world where there's clients to a world where there's counterparty risk. They're no longer clients. They represent some sort of a risk which you have to now maintain and measure. You know, as we watched Bear Stearns collapse, Lehman Brothers get embroiled, and a number of other financial institutions start to look left and right and say, who actually have we been doing business with, and have we overextended ourselves?
Well, and you're not talking necessarily about our own clients. What you're talking about are, we are clients of the bank, they're clients of ours, you know, that type of thing, and they're counterparties. They have to stay solvent to be able to pay us what we need when we put money in their institution.
That's right. So it's at every institutional level, whether it's the banks, whether it's the brokerage firms, whether it's corporations managing their cash facilities. Kevin, I mean, what we saw in the 2006 to 2008 period was the beginning of a collapse in credit.
Yeah.
Well, actually a continuation of a collapse in credit.
Which is an increase in counterparty risk.
It is. And so round one culminated in what we now look back at is the crisis of 2008. And round two is just in front of us.
Okay.
So if, in fact, a credit crisis is looming and we have something akin to deflation immediately in front of us, what does that mean for the dollar? What does that mean for treasury? What does that mean for gold and silver? What does that mean for a whole host of asset classes? We want to put that in perspective today, Kevin. A discussion, a look at deflation and its ramifications.
So that's later. But, you know, finance reform passed this week. So
sure.
Actually, you talked about a round two coming about. I thought this financial reform was really going to keep this from ever happening again.
Kevin, if it's anything like the health care bill, which has everything, including the kitchen sink thrown into it, what you saw happen this last week was fascinating. In order to get bipartisan support, every legislator gets to throw in a pet project for constituencies back in their home state.
Right.
You know, this is how you get legislation passed. If for anyone who thinks that they can change Washington, or if they were to get elected to office, could go back and sort of take us back to a bygone era, it's laudable, but also a little bit laughable, because the name of the game in Washington is compromise.
Right.
And so when someone puts together a mammoth piece of legislation and you realize that there's critical mass in terms of people who will vote for it, you don't try to stop it. You just make sure that you've got something in it that's of benefit to you in the long run and guarantees your reelection.
Well, the amazing thing, David, about that health care bill, too, is there was some health care issues in the bill. I mean, I was amazed. There were actual things that applied to health care. But, oh, my gosh, the pork that was in there that had nothing to do with health care.
So what's best for America has all of a sudden become secondary to what's best for my, quote-unquote, re-election bid. If you're in a public office, what kind of pork do I have to bring back to my constituencies in order to buy their votes? I mean, it's the epitome of corruption, but it's a part of the system.
Mm-hmm.
Is an incumbent re-elected because of his vast experience and contribution to liberty, democracy? Or is it because, like a drug pusher, he gets his turf addicted to smack? So in this case, earmarks, other federal spending programs that bring back money to his or her state, this is why we can't balance the budget. Nobody's interested in balancing the budget because you realize it's a part of the game.
Because people are addicted to the government smack. And, you know, if they don't get it, they revolt at the polls.
That's exactly right. And there isn't a professional politician across the country that's willing to sacrifice. And this is a professional politician. There are some people who go back and say, I'm here for a term and then I'm gone. I want to do my public service and then that's it.
We've got a couple of clients that actually do that, that go in to actually try to change things in government.
But not a professional politician amongst them who would sacrifice a career for the betterment of his country. We've passed the Rubicon, Kevin. We're over the river. It was interesting, Kevin, this last week I was able to spend some time with an individual who spent 40 years in D.C. with at least three administrations. And it was explained to me that once a piece of legislation is passed, it takes between 40 and 50 years of a concerted effort to reverse that piece of legislation. And in many instances, it's impossible. So once it is done, it is done. The heralds trumpet the victory of health care, and now this, not last week, with financial reform. let's hope that we're not disappointed by the outcomes of the legislation, because it's going to be with us well beyond our lifetimes and will in fact be the legacy that our children and grandchildren have to endure.
Speaking of healthcare reform, why do we find non-healthcare issues in this legislation?
Well, that's the point. Everything, including the kitchen sink, is in there. As with the financial reform, we're going to find all kinds of things that have nothing to do with financial reform.
Right.
But in 2,300 pages, yeah, they're more than commas and periods and exclamation points just filling the space.
Well, it's an amazing thing. People will call and they'll say, hey, what's this mean to us? And it's like, okay, 2,300 pages. There's not a congressman who passed this thing that really knows what it means.
Now, in the healthcare, you were mentioning that, Kevin, 1099s on all transactions, purchases. If you buy something for over $600, you'll have to give your Social Security number.
Wait a second. So you're talking about all transactions over $600?
Yeah.
You have to start giving a Social Security number? And this is with the healthcare bill.
This is with the healthcare bill. Now, we're not talking about healthcare transactions where you're buying a bottle of oxygen because you've got bad circulation or something like that. We're talking about every $600 purchase. Well, let's see. A new lawnmower at Sears. And of course, as a part of the legislation, well, actually, they didn't cover this, but Sears will be responsible for maintaining a secure database of Social Security numbers.
For people who buy lawnmowers
over
greater $600.
This is the absurdity, because again, we're talking about healthcare, and of course, 1099s on all transactions for purchases over $600, this has nothing to do with healthcare. And honestly, we've already got 91 people back in D.C. who are willing to repeal this part. If you as a listener don't get a hold of your elected representative and say, this is patently absurd, you're treating me like a patsy.
Well, David, 20 states are in revolt right now. And so, you know, I mean, they're actually bucking this right now.
Well, they're bucking the whole trend with the health care and the mandatory requirements.
Right.
But what I'm saying is every one of our listeners needs to get in touch with their elected official, write a letter, make a phone call, and say, this whole 1099 bit, as a small business owner, you don't understand. It's going to cost me $6 per transaction just to file the 1099.
Well,
we're talking
about
tens
privacy.
Of thousands of dollars per year. For a small business owner, that can be the difference between profit and loss.
Dave, think about your privacy. You're going to have a Social Security number at every institution or every dealership that possibly can sell you something for more than $600.
In an era of identity theft, we're now handing out the most important number tied to our identity, handing it out willy-nilly.
And that has to do with health care.
Of course. Yeah. Isn't that clear? Well, a little bit of an issue with the health care bill. The point is, everything is in the financial reform bill, too, to keep us safe from ourselves, safe from other people, and who knows what else we'll find as time goes on. Kevin, one final point to be made on the health care bill. I realize this is not the financial reform bill, which is far more important from last week, but you've got 20 states in revolt, right? And you've got Obama, who, after explaining to the general public that this was not a tax,
he said not a tax.
Now, in response to the states trying to reject the mandatory requirements of the bill, 20 states, they're being told in court that the federal government can mandate the legislation on the basis of its power to tax.
So it's not a tax until you need it to be a tax. And then when in the courts you need it to be a tax, it's a tax.
Yeah. So if you as an individual think that government is benign, honestly, you're either insanely naive to world history, or, in fact, you're one of the SMAC-dependent individuals, mega corporations, or constituency groups that has a very twisted view of reality because of the kickbacks you're getting from federal revenues, tax revenues, from your fellow Americans.
Right.
Just understand who you're benefiting on the back of. I mean, that's what I have the biggest problem with here, is every piece of legislation that gets passed, these monster 2,000-4,000-page pieces of legislation, they're corrupt.
Right.
At base, they're corrupt. I wrote a little satirical piece on the financial regulatory reforms on our wealth management site.
Yeah, that's an understatement, David. It was very satirical. Very actually cynical. I hate to say it, but
so if you
worth the read.
If you care to indulge, mwealthm.com, you'll see the comments from this week. It's not for literalists. And anyone could write satire with Goldman's version of mea culpa this last week.
Mm.
Has anyone raised children in the audience?
They got their hands slapped, right?
Well, if you've raised kids, you look into their little eyes and hear with all sincerity that I didn't do it. I didn't do it.
Right.
And this is Goldman. We didn't do anything wrong. We didn't do anything wrong. Now, granted, they pay $550 million, the largest penalty on fraud charges ever handed out from the SEC. Is this a reputational blow? Yeah, honestly, the general public's going to forget within 2 weeks.
Mm.
I mean, it's just the nature of the markets. It matters today, and it's reason for riot and revolt until tomorrow, and then we've got other things to focus on. Well, focusing on things that are right in front of us, earnings season is in full swing. The market priced in, if you watch this most recent rally, Kevin, an upside surprise, and had assumed that we were, in fact, in a recovery in the economy. And on the basis of earning expectations, and they based that on government guidance and government numbers and everything else, even a few weeks ago, you remember Kevin Obama's comments on unemployment. It dropped from 9.7 to 9.5.
Yeah, he said, make no mistake about this. You know, we are on the right track.
Well, it was 652,000 people that were no longer on the unemployment rolls. That's what helps the numbers improve.
So they just dropped them off.
That's the point. It depends on how you want to spend the information. Mm-hmm. If you count those people, 652,000, they left the labor force. They're no longer counted as unemployed, but they're not employed either. Counting them back in, which they should be because they're still unemployed, you're not at 9.5, you're 10.1%.
Well, and David, let's face it, that's probably the reason they really had to focus on getting them off the list, because at this point, we're double digit.
And that's scary because we are at a critical juncture in terms of perception management. We've got corporations which are still doing that, playing their earnings games, mm-hmm. reserve assets, previously written down assets. You can take write-downs on the value of company debt, or you can mark up special asset pools. All these things are being done, bringing the numbers in line in terms of the expectations for earnings. They're games, Kevin. And if you wanted to simplify it, manipulation of reality. Intel had a great quarter. Supplying products to Apple does help. But companies like GE, with sales and earnings in decline, tried to convince the market that they did, in fact, beat expectations. And the market ran a very cold judgment of the numbers and ignored the earnings as a simple farce.
Do you think, David, that people are starting to wake up a little bit to this creative accounting? I don't know how else to call it. I mean, it's accounting that really doesn't represent reality.
Sure. Well, this is the game, the charade that's played every earnings season. We don't have to pay attention to sales and revenues because earnings, with the expectations and then either meeting or beating those expectations, which are arbitrary numbers to begin with, you can really control the perception of the value of the stock and where the company is going and what momentum they're building or not building, et cetera, et cetera.
Do you think it had anything to do with the recent comments that the Fed has been making, saying that we may not even recover for the next 5 to 6 years? That's uncharacteristic for the Fed, David.
Volatility in the market certainly is not helped and is hurt by Fed comments like that. But it is a realistic appraisal. So the most recent Fed comments were issued last week, as you mentioned. And yeah, full recovery can't be accomplished in the next 5 to 6 years. Mm. At the same time, you've got 100% of the votes in the FOMC which do not see a double dip as a possibility.
Right.
So we're not recovering. It's going to take us a long time to recover. We certainly have headwinds, but we will not see a double dip. We have consensus. And if this isn't a credibility blow, well, let's give them the benefit of the doubt. Let's get to the end of November and see if the economy has recovered, and then maybe reappoint them all, if they're right. And if they're wrong, and we doubled it, because, I mean, granted, these are all professionals, many of them PhDs, many of them monetary historians, they should know, right?
Yeah.
If they get this wrong, 100% of them get it wrong, not one dissenting voice, can we fire them all?
Yeah, the thing that's amazing to me, too, David, is I think probably they're saying no recovery for 5 to 6 years so that they can send a signal that they're going to be printing money and keeping the interest rates low for longer. Isn't there a fear right now? I mean, they've created this monster that they call deflation, and we've talked about deflation. But when they say there's no recovery, it's strange how people will react. They'll be like, oh, good, the Fed doesn't think there's going to be a recovery. That means they're going to print. That means interest rates are going to stay low. Isn't that part of the motive?
Yeah, this brings us to our main point today, because as the visible scales tip in the direction of deflation, the Fed is having to come to terms with quantitative easing, one, and the unprecedented spending programs that merely kept the patient alive. I mean, it didn't get us to recovery.
Yeah, let's talk about real estate. I mean, that's one of the main things that they say caused this crisis in the first place. How many people have come back above water in real estate? I mean, where are we at?
Now, you still have 11 to 12 million homeowners underwater, Kevin. Now, are we going to see a different set of strategies come from the FOMC? I mean, does the failure of the first round of quantitative easing, does that diminish the odds of a second round?
Well, don't we have a lot of debt that's actually needing to be rolled over in the next couple of years? I mean, that's critical to not just taking out new debt, but we just have to still be able to roll over the old stuff.
Well, and we'll get to that in just a minute, because what we really are dealing with when you're talking about Ben Bernanke is reputation and ego being on the line. Academics are rare, very rare, when they can look at new inputs and new data and submit themselves to a gestalt switch or a paradigm switch where they realize, you know, was going about this all wrong. And actually, my PhD thesis isn't going to cut the mustard on this. So better change course before we make a train wreck of this whole thing. This is the issue, Kevin. Kane's ghost is here to stay.
Right.
And with it, we will see an incredible fight against deflation. Today, we want to explore the subject of deflation. You
right.
mentioned, you know, there's debts that need to be rolled over. $5 trillion in bank debt needs to be rolled over between now and 2012 on a global basis.
Right. That's not even the new stuff.
Much of that is in Europe. About 1.6 here in the U.S. and the rest is in Europe. Exactly. That's not new debt. That's
right.
rolling over the old, which is just maturing. $2.5 trillion in U.S. Treasury obligations need to be rolled over between now and 2012. As you mentioned, that doesn't include the deficit spending that we are sort of adding to the new stock of debt, which also has to be financed.
Okay, now that's the stuff that can be monetized, they can print money, but what about municipalities? I mean, that's coming due as well.
We're seeing fissures, cracks are spreading from one state to another. Kevin, we've already had 35 municipalities in default since the beginning of this year, 2010, and there are more issuers on the brink.
And they can't print their way out of that one.
They can't, but what that does imply is that ultimately the Fed has to step in and monetize or somehow create a backstop for the municipalities. Does that do anything to help our credit rating globally? Our standing, the U.S. government, its standing today is AAA, and we'll talk about how that's changed internationally here in the last week or so. But according to Fitch, Moody's, S&P, our credit rating is still AAA.
Well,
as you begin to add all of these things onto the balance sheet of the Fed, does it deserve a AAA rating?
Well, and that's my question. For decades, we've been recommending people, if they're not going to be in gold, they go to treasury bills. That's the safest quote, safest form of paper that you can own. Are you questioning that at this point, David?
Well, it's safest on a relative basis. And we'll talk about this a little bit in a minute, Kevin, because this is the problem. On a relative basis, maybe.
Right.
On an absolute basis, no. No, treasuries are not safe. All that to say, Kevin, all these debts that are coming due, the new debts that we add on to it, the remainder of this year and next year, we are likely to see an unwinding of bad debts. And that's immediately in front of us.
Mm-hmm.
So this is why we're exploring the subject of deflation today. It's been argued by many that a move to cash or treasuries is really the safe haven allocation that you should go to in a deleveraging environment.
And, right.
and that may hold as long as, this is the key word, as long as the perception of stability is maintained, as long as our creditors have not grown suspicious of our underlying currency or of our country's IOUs and the stability that we inherently have as a AAA-rated country, our credit rating, we believe perception has been altered in the last 24 months, and that only people, the only people, moving to treasuries and cash in the next round of deleveraging will be fund managers. Will be fund managers who are locked into a thought pattern, fund managers who are locked into a knee-jerk response. I can tell you from looking at the traffic into metals in our office, the number of significant investors coming in to metals, and they're viewing it as a currency alternative.
Right. Instead of just a crisis hedge, it's now currency.
Exactly. And so there has been a mind shift amongst a certain number of people who have said, we don't perceive the U.S. dollar as stable. We don't perceive the U.S. balance sheet and our future obligations as tenable. And we're going to take proactive steps to ensure our survival, our financial wherewithal into the next generation. That's happened. That's happened already. Smart money has made that move and is in the process of making that move. The money that won't make that move is the not-so-smart money. And I think they do, in fact, go into treasuries and live to regret it. And I don't know how long it takes them to learn to regret it.
Well, you know, David, a couple of examples of that. You've got people who own businesses who are moving into gold with what they call their current account or what they're actually going to use to pay their bills. People who have kids going into college who know on a semester-by-semester basis they're going to need that cash. I've had people going into gold with that. Yeah.
Well, already, Kevin, a Chinese rating agency just last week downgraded, this is profound, downgraded the U.S., downgraded the U.K., downgraded France, and downgraded Germany, all who previously had AAA-rated status to AA. Now, would Moody's or Fitch agree with that? Clearly not. Not on their life.
Not yet
no.
on their life.
Not yet on their life.
Yeah.
But they did, Moody's, or I think Fitch actually, downgraded Ireland last week.
Mm.
The issue with these rating agencies, Kevin, we've already seen their inherent weakness. They have a vested interest in skewing the numbers. Mm-hmm. The mortgage-backed securities market, the securitization which occurred, and the distribution of collateralized loan obligations, collateralized debt obligations, all of these things were signed, sealed, and delivered by Moody's and S&P, stamped with their AAA rating, and distributed to the world as legitimate AAA paper.
Until the day they failed.
Until the day they failed. Yeah. And then even after that, it took them some weeks to come to terms with their miscalculation, quote-unquote. And I just wonder if it's not actually they're held hostage from a political standpoint and can't, when it comes to sovereign entities, downgrade those who they are, let's call it political capture. They are held hostage by the United States. How do you operate as a business in the United States and curry political favor when you've just told your political masters that they're not a good bet?
Right.
Oops.
Yeah.
Oops. I mean,
you've got to be careful there.
You really do. But foreigners, this is the difference, Kevin. Foreigners can see it.
Right.
Pension liabilities, municipal defaults, quantitative easing, monetization, both installment one and pending part two, credit market turmoil triggered by a rollover squeeze. I mean, all of these things, Kevin, foreigners are saying, in the last 2 years, I think we've learned a few things.
Well, you know, it reminds me of what even Jeremy Grantham said just recently. He says, increasingly, the cure seems to be more just a stay of execution. I mean, that's really all it is.
Well, that's what quantitative easing one did. It just bought us some time, but it didn't fix anything. So many other issues end up flowing upstream, if you will, to the implicit or explicit Fed and Treasury promises to keep the patient alive. We have bought time, we've stayed execution, and as long as we can manage perceptions, like the administration's call on unemployment, managing perceptions, saying that this is a recovery, a drop from 9.7 to 9.5%, and we're off and running towards recovery, folks.
Right.
And guess what? It is a blatant manipulation of data.
Pay no attention to the 600,000 that dropped off the list, plus 600,000, yeah.
But if there's enough suckers who will keep the game in play, Kevin, then I think we can avoid the consequences of deflation.
Yeah.
And if we can't, then we are looking at an end game in terms of debt liquidation and something that looks far worse than the fall of 2008. It reminds me, Kevin, of what you have called the suspension of disbelief.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting concept, because as long as everybody plays ball, we can have this fiat currency system, we can be loaning each other money, as long as we can trust that nobody's going to disbelieve that the system works. Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. McIlvaney.com.
What does a suspension of disbelief look like when you're watching a movie?
Okay, well, when you go to a movie, and I sometimes have a hard time with this, to be honest with y'all, I need to suspend my disbelief so I can actually enjoy the show. But if there's any flaw, let's say somebody's munching on popcorn, okay, or some flaw in the movie or the script, immediately you start disbelieving that you're actually in that scenario.
It's not realistic.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Now, let's apply that maybe to the fiat markets, okay?
But it's the same is true on stage. Someone has to enter character to be a good actor.
Right.
And they have to know that they are not, say, for instance, Petruchio.
Yeah, the only guy who actually plays himself all the time is Jack. Okay, everybody else has to play somebody else at some time.
Right. Well, exactly. And this has been my criticism of some actors. All they play is themselves. They don't have the ability to act and play anyone else.
Right.
But a good actor takes on a stage presence and believes that they are that person. And they set aside the disbelief,
right,
the counterbalance, which would say, no, I actually have a core identity, and it's not the role that I'm playing from the script that I'm reading from. That same thing has to occur with the people in the crowd.
Yeah.
The belief that this actor is the person they are perceived to be on stage, but, and not the person they are off stage.
It's a mutual agreement, and people actually pay money to make the agreement to suspend their disbelief for whatever it is, an hour and a half, 2 hours, whatever it is.
This is the issue, Kevin, with our treasury market and with the U.S. dollar.
Right.
There is a suspension of disbelief. We have a crowd of people who are willing to say, we'll go on and play this game as long as you go on and play your game, and it's mutually beneficial, and we will agree to ignore the fact that you're unstable and insolvent. But that's okay, because we're both benefiting in some way from this relationship.
But David, what happens when one person, one country, one event, all of a sudden creates disbelief in the system? I'll use the example of the Europeans, okay? The Europeans were talking austerity. Obama immediately came in and said, you know,
G20 meeting, he waltzes in and says, austerity's for the birds. Guys, this is where, if we've learned anything from Keynes, this is where you push the pedal to the metal. We've got to accommodate the markets. We've got to spend more money. If it means bloating our balance sheets, we'll do that. And we have to do it on a concerted basis. At this point, you got to understand, we all operate on a relative basis. No one is particularly strong. We're all relatively weak.
Right.
But if anyone's going to stand out and take strides towards being some sort of a hero in this environment, that's not smart. Politically, that's not smart. I'm here to tell you it's politically not smart. This was Obama's message at the G20.
Right.
So scrap the austerity measures and start spending just like us so that we all look the same to the world.
Just because you think your debt is too much to pay, don't worry about it. Go into more debt. Print more money.
As we said before, Kevin, want to cover the issue of deflation.
Right.
Several things have occurred in the last 10 years, Kevin, which are worthy of note. The biggest of which is that all assets have deflated relative to gold.
Yeah.
The bond market has deflated relative to gold. Housing has deflated relative to gold. Commercial real estate has deflated relative to gold.
The stock market
has deflated relative to gold. In nominal prices, the stock market is off only a little bit in a 10-year period.
Right.
Relative to gold, it's off over 65%. Housing's the same. Yeah, a $300,000 house just at the beginning part of this decade would have cost you 1,000 ounces of gold.
That was at $300 gold.
Right.
Yeah.
$300,000 divided by $300 an ounce, 1,000 ounces of gold is what it cost you. Now it's about 300 ounces of gold.
That's how much the house has devalued versus gold, or gold has valued up versus the house.
Correct. And so we've been in a deflationary trend relative to real money for over a decade.
Hmm.
Now, real money is the issue. This is the point. I read a lot of people, Kevin, a lot of deflationists, a lot of inflationists, the Faberites, and some folks who argue for extreme hyperinflation and a Zimbabwe-style collapse of our economy and our monetary system. And I think they actually have some good points to make.
Yeah.
All of them.
Right.
All of them. So when I read the deflationists, one of the biggest weaknesses I see is this. The definition of money has changed and no one has noticed.
Right.
You go back to 1922, and these are four dates that I would write down.
Yeah.
22, 33, 44.
44.
And 1971.
Right. Okay.
These are significant dates in terms of the definition of money here in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
1922 was the Conference of Genoa, where we agreed that you could hold not only gold as a reserve asset on your balance sheet as a central bank, but you could also hold foreign currencies as well.
So up to that point, just to restate what the gold standard was, up to that point, you could walk into a bank with a $20 bill and walk out with an ounce of gold because the reserves were pretty much one-to-one.
And in terms of foreign trade, it equated the same way.
Yeah.
If there was an outstanding debt, it could be paid in gold and only in gold. And now, for sake of convenience, according to the folks at the Conference of Genoa, it made sense to have currency there as well instead of just gold.
So 1922 change was the first dilution of the gold standard.
And that's what we called then and thereafter the gold exchange standard.
Right.
1933 is the next significant event, and it's when people began to change their perception of money on a forced basis by government. Government said, you can't actually hold gold, but we'll hold the gold for you,
right,
and your paper script is worth just what it was before. We've got all of that stuff at Fort Knox, and though you can't exchange it for gold, it's there, trust us.
Yeah, well, the dollar was as good as gold as far as the perception of the people at the time.
But we begin to use paper script as if it is gold, when gold is, in fact, the only real money.
Right.
But that's okay. This is a conditioning which has taken decades to occur. 1944 comes about, and we get to extend the definition of money, our dollar, backed by gold, of course,
right,
universally.
It was the world's reserve currency after Bretton Woods.
Exactly. Yeah. What happened in 1944 set the standard, and we replaced the British as the world's reserve currency. The sterling was no longer the reserve currency. You had their currency default in 1931, then again in 49, and then in 67, they were removed to a place of irrelevancy in the currency world, and we were there with Bretton Woods to emerge as the only reserve currency in the world.
Well, and David, you know, not everyone in Europe completely played ball on this. I mean, Jacques Rouff had talked to de Gaulle and said, look, the dollar really isn't as good as gold, and it probably won't be forever, so you probably want to trade it in while you can.
Well, he was looking at our balance sheet, frankly,
yeah,
Kevin. After the guns and butter spending of both the Korean and the Vietnam War, he's saying, I've seen this before.
Yeah.
I've seen this happen before. In fact, this is when Jacques Rouff was a young man. He was a financial attaché in Great Britain during what year? 1931, when the British devalued the sterling.
And when they went off the gold standard.
And when they went off, yes. So this is the issue. Here's a man of experience, now in his latter years, advising de Gaulle, their balance sheet is rotten.
Yeah.
And if they're going to make payment, you definitely want to do it with real money and not the paper promise to pay. So Nixon saw this happen, changed the rules in 68, and said, you have to ask permission.
Right.
If you want gold, it's no longer just a free as you may come with your requests. You have to ask permission. And Nixon went on to say, if you are a friend of America, you'll leave your gold here. It's just more convenient to do so.
Hint, hint.
Hint, hint.
Yeah.
So the French, in light of that hint, hint, did the wink, wink, nod, nod between themselves and said, okay, well, we'll just continue to take gold. Now we know the end game is nigh. And they were spot on. He closed the gold window. Nixon did in 1971. And that's why 71 is a significant date, because it's the first time in world history that we've had an entire monetary system with no gold backing anywhere. Anywhere. There was always one country that had gold backing somewhere.
Right.
Now we have an entirely fiat
system.
It's just
a paper system.
This is what's interesting, tying this into the deflation argument, that ultimately when you see a deleveraging event occur and people are scrambling for real money, they're assuming that real money and fiat money are no different. And they are different.
They are different. Well, if you go back and look at the historic charts, we have had deflations throughout history, but they've always been tied to some sort of gold standard currency. A deflation in a paper currency is just sort of meaningless, isn't it? I mean, as long as they can print as much as they want.
Well, and in this case, if you'd been in gold for the last 10 years, all assets have deflated relative to the fixed standard.
So the deflationists are right. They're just looking at the wrong thing. A lot of them are looking at the dollar saying, yeah, the dollar is actually going gaining value.
This is one of the issues. Assets that have any leverage put against them will be liquidated in the next 18 to 24 months. We're going into the second round of deleveraging.
Right.
And so if there are assets with leverage against them, the second shoe is getting ready to drop. How is the U.S. dollar any different? Because our balance sheet and the script which represents it, the U.S. dollar, guess what?
Right.
It's one of the most leveraged things on the planet. So leverage is what is destroying. An overexpansion of debt obligations and credit is ultimately what has to be unwound. And the dollar is front and center for that. The only thing that holds the dollar up as different than any other world currency is perception.
Right.
And I think perception is in the process, if it hasn't already changed. The Chinese this last week issuing their edict that this is no longer AAA paper. It's AA. It's a significant sentiment change.
Yeah.
That wasn't official from the Chinese state government. That was a rating agency within China. But it is a significant sentiment change. And it does signal that someone gets it. Someone understands that we are technically insolvent and that we can't just continue to expand our balance sheet from 2.4 at the Fed to 5 to 10 to 20 through the next round of quantitative easing without there being a tangible consequence in the capital markets, namely a downgrade to our debt because of a lower credit rating and an increase in our interest rates.
So it's questionable where they're going to go. You know, we've talked about people having to deleverage out of what they have. I mean, you're still saying commodities will drop. We're not talking about hyperinflation yet. So copper, nickel, aluminum, lumber, those types of things can deflate. But gold
is not copper.
It's not copper.
Gold is not a commodity.
It's a form of money.
This is what has changed. If we go back, this is why, you know, when you look at 22, 33, 44, 71, grill those numbers into your head. 1922, the gold exchange standard. 1933, the removal of gold from your individual hand. 1944, the extension of the U.S. dollar as the quote-unquote gold standard to the rest of the world. And then finally in 71, we move to a completely fiat system. We maintain the status as the quote-unquote gold standard throughout the world, and yet we've been running on fumes for decades. And only in the context of a deflationary collapse do you see a game change in terms of perception?
Well, right there you have the suspension of disbelief, because we're still believing, in a way, in an old perception, which was that the dollar was backed by gold.
So the deleveraging, which is immediately in front of us, the deflation, if you will, that is going to occur over the next 2 years, has everything to do with leveraged assets, either leveraged because you have debt against them, That's what I'm using as one definition.
Like real estate.
Exactly. Yeah. Real estate, commercial real estate, residential real estate. Farmland is generally a cash purchase. Not very many people take loans out against it. I think people learned their lesson in the 1930s.
Right.
That was the biggest source of lending through the 1920s was to productive farmland. And that got unwound, by the way. That got unwound in the 1930s. You didn't see a massive hemorrhaging in the commercial and residential real estate market because there really wasn't a fully developed lending institution to those markets in the 1920s. The collateral was not considered significant enough,
right.
Whereas farmland, productive and with cash flow, was in fact considered significant by the banking industry of that day.
Well, it was almost cliche. I mean, you think about the Grapes of Wrath or any of the old Depression types of stories. It was about people losing their farms, their leveraged farms, to the bank.
But it was leverage. It was debt that killed. Okay, so that's one version. The other version is anything else that is leveraged to GDP. In other words, not a lending leverage, but where the growth of the asset is dependent on a growth in GDP. Mm-hmm. That could be copper, that could be nickel, that could be any of your industrial commodities, that could be palladium or platinum. I mean, these are issues that will, in a deflationary collapse, feel the pain.
Right.
There is no leverage to GDP, and there is no debt against, there is no counterparty, there is nothing in the backdrop with gold. Gold is not copper. Gold is not a commodity. Gold is a currency, and it is the preferred currency. Has been. We've forgotten it, and it will be.
And that's why it goes up during a deflation, a true deflation, not down.
Well, so is silver any different? I'm not sure, Kevin. I think actually silver could have a lot more headwinds in the context of a deflation because of its industrial uses. On the other hand, it does and has served as a monetary metal.
Right.
And the global demand for gold will outstrip any available supplies to the point where the price is high enough that I don't think people will be able to afford it. The common man will not be able to buy gold, and silver will be the only monetary metal, and it will have a secondary and probably even more powerful play as we move from deflation to inflation.
Well, and that was my question. Has a deflation historically ever ended in a deflation?
Never. Every deflation has ended with an inflationary trend as the monetary authorities have tried to fix the situation with all the tools at their disposal. This is the point, Kevin. This ends up being one of the most epic battles when you include the monetary authorities that we have, not only in the United States, but globally, with the educational backgrounds that they have and the policy tools in their hands. This is according to Bernanke in his speech from 2002. Quote, deflation is always reversible under a fiat money system, end quote. Now, we already talked about that. 1971 launched us on an entirely fiat system. There's no one around the world who has a different monetary constraint. In fact, they have the same freedoms and liberties to print and create as much credit and money as they want. This is the next part of the quote. U.S. dollars have a value only to the extent that they are strictly limited in supply. But the U.S. government has a technology called a printing press, or today its electronic equivalent, that allows it to produce as many U.S. dollars as it wishes at essentially no cost. By increasing the number of U.S. dollars in circulation, or even by credibly threatening to do so, the U.S. government can also reduce the value of a dollar in terms of goods and services, which is the equivalent of raising the prices in dollars of those goods and services. We conclude that under a paper money system, a determined government can always generate higher spending and hence positive inflation. End quote. Kevin, this is the point. We do have deflation. What we have at the end of any recession, liquidation has to occur. It has to occur.
And it is.
Is it going to occur over a 6-month period of extreme pain or a 20-year period like the Japanese have seen, where they've obscured the bank balance sheets in Japan and not allowed those bad bets to go sour? Is that what happens to the Fed as they absorb more and more and more and more bad debts, put them on their balance sheet, and know that they can be disgorged in an orderly fashion when the market's not in a panic over the next 25 years?
Right.
Do you know what that does to the stability of the U.S. dollar and the U.S. debt market, the new U.S. bond market?
It just goes right off the cliff.
Not pretty.
Yeah.
Not pretty. What's the judgment of our foreign creditors in that environment? I don't know. I don't have a crystal ball to know why they make their decisions. Do they act as rational actors and say, yeah, I'm willing to take that loss.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Swing hard. Hit me in the chin. I'd love to. Feels great. Sign up for it any day. This is the point. We don't know if they behave rationally or if they behave politically. Rationally in terms of economic and financial.
They would just sell dollars. They'd get out of dollars.
Or do they act on a politically motivated basis?
Right.
We don't know how that spells out in terms of our foreign creditors and their behavior. But we do know that individuals and wealthy family offices and, on a growing basis, institutions, even a few of your largest insurance companies, have said, you know what? I think we want to own some gold. I don't care what the environment is. This is unstable. This is what we would define as an uncertain environment. We see with the people that we talk to, with our management team and advisors, anxiety. We see a growing temperature in the market, and it's one that indicates fear. Is there anything that we can own, inflation, deflation, that makes sense regardless? Guess what it ends up being?
Yeah.
Guess what the decision is that they're making right now? And in spite of the deflationist argument that you don't want to own anything that's a commodity, what the deflationists have forgotten is that gold is not a commodity.
It's money.
It's money, and it's the chief currency in the midst of crisis.
And so,
inflationary crisis or deflationary crisis.
You know, David, the bottom line on this talk right now on what we're talking about on deflation, for those who are waiting, and I've heard this from certain people who are watching these markets and reading certain newsletters, the people who are waiting for a severe drop in the gold price versus dollars because they think it's going to be deflation, they're missing the point. They need to be buying gold right now because gold actually is a positive gainer in a deflation.
Well, Kevin, we've seen the last 10 years a deflation in terms of pricing in every asset class. And the standout has been gold. I think it'll continue to be that way until this cycle finishes itself, whether it looks on the surface like a deflationary deleveraging or an inflation at the monetary level, a hyperinflation that ultimately increases prices dramatically in the marketplace. Listen, it just behooves individuals to stay the course, because what we have is a 10-year trend which has been so steady, so consistent, and it has not resolved itself. If you look at the Dow Gold Ratio, and we harp on this all the time,
right,
the Dow Gold Ratio started at 43 to 1, declined to 20, declined to 15, declined to 10, declined to 7. We're now below the 10 level on our way to a 3 to 1 ratio, a 1 to 1 ratio if geopolitics gets involved, which we think it will. Which means this trend has not resolved itself.
Right.
Either the whole world collapses around us and gold stays even where it is today, and on a relative basis, the only winner, or on a supply and demand basis, as people panic out of $155 to $200 trillion in paper assets after they've watched that get shellacked and diminished by half, which could happen in the next 2 years. If they even allocate a small portion as a survival mechanism into gold, you realize you double or triple the volumes into gold, and the price moves exponentially from there to $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 an ounce.
Well, David, I might mention that you're going to be speaking in much more detail about this in San Francisco in August and in New Orleans in October. And for people, listeners who would like to come not only hear you and see this, but actually meet with you and have private consultations, we would recommend that the listeners to the show call us here at 800-525-9556. Ask for Karis or extension 118 to let us know that they're going to come to the show. I mean, David, you're going to be talking about these very things in much more detail at that time.
And we'll have an opportunity to strategize with individuals there in person.
Okay.
Kevin, what I'm saying and what history has proven out is that whether it's inflation or deflation, gold is the monetary metal for all seasons.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. You can also call us at 1-800-525-9556. Thanks for listening.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.